From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, we'll be talking about the pause in administering the COVID-19 vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, and specifically what that means for ongoing efforts at immunization in Illinois. We'll also hear what's driving a surge in cases in the Peoria area. That's coming up later this hour. But first, about an hour west of Chicago, just outside Batavia, you can find one of the most powerful particle physics laboratories in the world, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, part of the U.S. Department of Energy and commonly known as Fermilab. Since 1967, scientists at Fermilab have looked for answers to questions about the universe, like how did the universe begin? And what secrets do the smallest particles hold? And how can they help us understand space and time? Just last week, Fermilab released findings that suggest there is more to reality than we presently understand. The findings are long-anticipated results from the Muon G-2 experiment, which uses a 15-ton electromagnetic ring and particles that are similar to electrons. Joining us now from Fermilab to talk about the Muon G-2 experiment and what the findings could mean for science is physicist Brandon Kieburg. Brandon, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. Maybe you have a question about this specific experiment at Fermilab or just a comment about scientific discovery in general. The number to call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Brandon, before we get into the details of the and the nuances of the Muon G-2 experiment, let's talk about, just take a step back, and what do the findings of this mean? What could this mean for our understanding of science, of the universe?
Great. Yeah. So in physics, we have a thing called the Standard Model, which is basically an organized group of all of the particles and forces that we know about. And these really make up the building blocks of nature. So you could think about it like a periodic table of particles, the same way we have a periodic table of elements. And the things like electrons and protons and neutrons make up all the matter we see around us. But what's so interesting is that there are big questions that these particles and forces by themselves can't explain. So for example, when we look out into space, we see that galaxies are rotating faster than you would expect just from the visible matter. And so we know at some level that this model is incomplete, and we're looking for evidence of new particles that can be added to that model. And that's what this experiment is really trying to get at.
Maybe it would be helpful to think about the scale you're working at here. I mean, for a lot of us, it's been a while since we've had classes in physics. When we're talking about these particles, how small are we talking about?
Wow, they're extremely small. They're basically point particles. We think that they take up no physical extent as they are. One of the interesting things about the experiment itself is that we have an enormous racetrack that the particles race around on, and that's actually 50 feet in diameter. But the particles themselves are really, really tiny, and they're just interacting with our giant magnet.
And I mean, how does this compare to like an atom, right? Things that we all learned about in high school chemistry or physics or something like that.
Yeah. So the atom consists of these particles, but the particles themselves basically take up no space at all. So most of the atom is actually empty space made up of these few point particles. So, I mean, this is basically zooming in with a microscope into an atom, where an atom would be an enormous object like the sun, and we're just looking at some tiny little speck inside of that.
Wow! So micro, nano. I don't even know what prefix you use when you're talking about these sorts of things. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about then what is a muon and what does the G-2 stand for in the title of the experiment?
Yeah, absolutely. So particles like electrons make up everyday matter, but they also have these heavier, unstable cousins, and the muon is one of them. So it's about 200 times more massive than an electron, but it has charge, like an electron has charge, and it has this other cool property called spin, which basically lets you think of it as a little spinning top. And it has another property, which is that it's unstable, meaning that it will actually decay into an electron and two really hard to detect particles called neutrinos. And the muon only lives for about 2 millionths of a second before it decays. So we collect a whole bunch of these muons, and we put them in our giant magnetic racetrack, and we let them race around until they decay. You asked also a little bit about the G. So the G stands for the gyromagnetic ratio. And really what the G is getting at is how strongly does the particle interact with the magnetic field. So if the G factor is larger, then the particle is going to spin around a little bit faster in a magnetic field. So just think of a gyroscope or a top and how fast it's wobbling about the about gravity. And if G is smaller, it will wobble less quickly. And we do an incredibly precise measurement of this number. We actually measure it to about 8 decimal places to understand its value.
Yeah, I saw a chart of this, and I was trying to wrap my brain around. So let me try an analogy on you here as to what the experiment is doing. I mean, let's say you have a race car and you have a racetrack, and you do all this math, and you know the weight of the car and the rubber on the tires is a certain chemical composition, and you have this fuel, and you make a very precise calculation about how fast you think the car will go, you know, around the track, and then you're observing a difference in what actually happens, and then you have to try and figure out, well, what is causing the difference? I mean, how does that work, or where is the flaw in my thinking here?
Yeah, well, your thinking is great. We do measure how fast the car zips around the racetrack. One of the really odd things about particles is that not only do they move around with momentum or speed, they actually have this sort of angular momentum to them, this thing called spin. So in your race car analogy, just imagine that not only are the race cars moving around the track, but they're constantly doing donuts as they go. That's a really good analogy for what these particles are doing in the experiment. And it's how fast they're doing these donuts while they're racing around the racetrack, which is the thing in particular that we care about. And it tells us how strongly the muons interact with this magnetic field. One of the cool things is that the theorists can write down all the particles that we know about in the universe. And these particles pop in and out of existence while this race car is going around the track. And when they pop in and out of existence, they sort of screen or influence the way how fast the race car is spinning. And so they can make a really precise prediction for how fast it should be doing these donuts. And we can do a really precise measurement to see how fast it's actually doing these donuts.
And when you say precise measurement, I think maybe we can drill in on that. I saw an analogy, I think it was on, I've read so much about this, but there was a video, I think, that Fermilab posted sort of explaining this. And it said, imagine you're measuring the length of a football field down to the precision of the width of a human hair. I mean, can you add some context to that?
Yeah, I mean, so we really are trying to understand this precisely calculated number to so many decimal places. So you can just imagine how enormous a football field is. And it, you know, if you whip out your tape measure, right, you can get a pretty good measurement. But the level that we care in order to be able to make a meaningful comparison to the calculation actually requires that our tape measure has the resolution of a human hair so that we know whether it's, 100 million human hairs or 100 million and 1 human hairs.
Can you let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the announcement of long anticipated early results from the muon G-2 experiment at Fermilab. We're speaking with Brendan Kieburg, who is a scientist there. And we are welcome your calls if you have any questions or comments about this. 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. Can you talk about what is it like being a particle physicist? Yeah, I saw you give a TEDx talk, almost a decade ago at this point, about moving the magnet to Fermilab. What has been going on between then and now to get to build up to the point where this announcement could be made last week?
Thanks. I'm smiling thinking back about the long road to getting this measurement out. I think one of the cool things about being a physicist is that we have a whole bunch of problems that we're trying to understand to get at really fundamental understanding of nature. But the day-to-day activities to arrive at those are, you know, a bunch of pretty normal steps. We build detectors that look at light made out of materials like plastic and crystal, and we put reflective tape on them to basically make the light collection really uniform. So there's some arts and crafts elements to that. And then we have to take measurements. So we use computers to look at the signals that are generated from these devices and take snapshots of these flashes of light that come out of our detectors. And then there's some work on, you know, at the desk where we sit down with pen and paper and a computer and do calculations and compute various quantities. So the day-to-day life of building an experiment and then performing a measurement where we go in and, you know, watch a bunch of computer monitors to make sure that everything is being collected properly, and then spending the time to analyze it and ask interesting questions and ask us, what is the data really telling us? What are the odd things in there? What are the things that were expected or unexpected? Is really a variety of skills and activities. And you referenced the transport of this magnet. I think this was a really cool example, because when I got into particle physics, you know, I thought I was going to just, you know, be looking at what is the universe made of? What are these big questions? What potential answers do we have? But in the move of this magnet, we actually brought the magnet from Brookhaven National Lab in New York to Fermilab over a 3,200 mile route on sea and on land. And the logistical complications in doing that required thinking about all sorts of different problems, like tidal forces when the magnet was actually on a barge in the ocean and on rivers. And so those are sort of the fun, cool things that we get to do that maybe we didn't expect to do when we got into this line of work.
Yeah, I'm trying to, so like part of the job, you're pretty much indistinguishable from an accountant sitting at a desk typing on a computer. And then part of the job, you're, you know, Tony Stark in the Iron Man lab doing all kinds of cool stuff with tech and everything else.
Well, it certainly sounds that way. That's a fun way of thinking about it. We definitely have a bunch of cutting edge technology and computing to go with the arts and crafts and spreadsheets.
what this magnet is fascinating to me, and I think this is something that listeners, there are videos online you can see this thing on a barge on a river going down the highway, taking up all the lanes. It had to be moved in the middle of the night. It's kind of looks like you know, the old 50s theremin music UFO kind of thing. 50 feet wide, 15 tons. Why was it moved from New York? Why not do the experiment there? Why recreate it in Illinois?
Excellent. Yeah. So here at Fermilab, around 2011 or so, we ended up developing the infrastructure to be able to repeat this experiment with 20 times the precision, which means we needed to collect 20 times the number of muons that they had at Brookhaven Lab. And so this was really an ideal place after the Tevatron to go in this new direction of precision measurements. So it was clear that this was the place to do the experiment. The big question was, they have this huge magnet there. It has these coils that, you know, are these sort of 15-ton devices, as well as 750 tons of steel that help make this magnet form in place. And we sort of had this wild idea that, well, what if we just brought it over there? And maybe it even started as a joke, but it really became a reality. We said, okay, this is something that we could do. It's really delicate. We had to make sure that this device didn't flex or twist more than a few millimeters over its 50-foot diameter. And so we really had to secure it in a very delicate manner and transport it very carefully. And that actually saved a lot of money. It would have cost $20 to $30 million to build this magnet from scratch here at the lab, plus however much time it would have taken, whereas we were able to transport it for a tenth of that cost from Brookhaven Lab.
Fascinating. So, and I'm imagining as you're going down, I mean, are like metal objects flying up to this thing? How does it actually work as a magnet? I mean, can you not walk past it with keys in your pocket?
Excellent question. Fortunately, it's a type of magnet called an electromagnet, which means that it's actually only energized when you plug it in. Okay, so we have a very fancy power supply. So I think you would think about it like a more like an MRI magnet, like you might have gone and had a medical procedure with. But you can basically unplug it and turn it off and de-energize it. And so that's the way that it was transported, and that's the way that it is when we need to perform work on it or install our detectors nearby it.
Okay, we need to take a break here. We're going to come back and continue this conversation and add some more context about where this finding fits in. Does it rate as a quote-unquote discovery in science? And where we go from here, we're going to continue this conversation with Brendan Kieburg about the muon G-2 experiment that is ongoing at Fermilab. There are some results that were announced recently. If you have a question, you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455 is the number to call, 800-222-9455. After we finish that conversation, we are also going to continue the show talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause and the COVID surge that has been happening in parts of Illinois, especially the Peoria area. So stay tuned for that as well. You're listening to The 21st. More to come after a break. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Fermilab physicist Brendan Kieburg about the latest findings of the muon G-2 experiment and how it may inform and challenge our understanding of the universe. Our number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Brendan, can you talk about the sort of eureka moment here? I saw a video clip where someone tore open an envelope and announced some findings, and there was sort of a yelp that went up over, I believe this was on a Zoom or some other video conferencing platform. Were you there for that? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a very exciting time about 6 weeks ago. Our whole collaboration got together, and we had, after years of work, made the decision that we understood what we were looking at well enough to actually perform something called an unblinding. In our experiment, we reference everything to a clock, but unlike your watch, we don't know the exact rate at which our clock ticks, and that's how we prevent sort of unconscious bias from steering us towards an answer that some people might want in order to be able to say there's really interesting new physics. So we prevent that bias by not knowing our clock frequency. And that eureka moment that that we had came when we decided, okay, now is the time. We've done all the work. Now's the time to find out what answer we get. And so inside that envelope was a number that told us exactly how quickly our clock ticks. And when we plugged that in, we were able to actually see what our experimental value is for this muon's G-2 in real units.
So when we learn about physics in school, we learn about these landmark discoveries, right? E equals MC squared, the apple falling on Newton's head. Where do you rate this? Let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the apple bonks Newton in the head, 1 being I did pretty good on my first vector physics exam in college.
Yeah, so this is a little bit different because we've understood this property of the muon exists, and there was this hint from when they performed that measurement at Brookhaven that the muon was basically doing those donuts a little bit too fast. So in our case, what was so exciting was a big moment for us was that we were able to confirm that measurement. We got an answer that actually agreed very well with that, and in addition, it differs from the calculation that the theorists make when they account for all the particles we know about. And so the reason people were so excited is because the sort of gap between what the theorists think and what the experimentalists measure could really be evidence that there are more particles out there or forces out there that we don't have in our standard model. At some level, we know this needs to be the case to explain some of the big questions, but now we have a stronger evidence of a specific window to look at to understand those particles and how they interact with the ones that we know about.
Is there competition among physicists? Like, I'm thinking back, a lot of the attention in the last decade or so has been on CERN, the European Council for Nuclear Research, the Higgs boson particle. There was a major announcement about that and finding about that in 2012. You know, does the muon G-2 experiment put Fermilab back on the map in some sense?
Well, Fermilab has been doing some really excellent science in a variety of neutrino, cosmic, precision measurements, as well as major contributors to those projects like the LHC. Yes, there's competition for sure, but there's also an awful lot of collaboration. In fact, if one experiment measures something, there's often a lot of healthy skepticism about whether they've done things correctly or not, or understood everything. And so what people often like to do is perform another experiment and show that, and determine if that other experiment sees the same thing, right? This is part of the scientific method, and it gets
replication
at sort of
you're talking about.
Yeah, gets at one of the fundamental principles, which is that this physics should be the same everywhere, in quotes, right? In multiple places. And so, yes, there's competition, and it's important to do this verification step as well. So we root for our competition to have exciting results as well.
I wonder, what is the timeline for work like this, right? I think the Higgs particle was something predicted 30 years before it was actually could be verified. I mean, what has been the timeline for this muon G-2 work? How many years of your life have you dedicated to this one experiment? Do people sort of, you know, retire, come on board? Is this something that's handed off over time?
Yeah, absolutely. All of that stuff is true. So the measurements that were taken at Brookhaven happened about 20 years ago. And about 10 years ago, we made the decision to try to bring this experiment here. We brought it in 2013. We put it back together and started taking data in 2018. So I say nowadays, with these enormous collaborations with hundreds or even thousands of people, it's not unusual to start planning an effort and have it take a decade before it starts collecting data. A place like the LHC in Switzerland will continue to run for multiple decades. And so people will retire, young people will come in and join and make contributions and take it in new directions because these tools are so versatile and interesting.
So the findings here, I understand that this is just there's only been a fraction of the data that will be collected has been analyzed. Can you talk about what is next as this experiment continues?
Yeah, absolutely. We've analyzed 6% of our data, so the data that came in 2018, and we've collected about 50% of the data that we plan to collect. And so the reason that we looked at this first portion was because it had a similar precision to the data that was published from Brookhaven about 15, 20 years ago. And so that was sort of a first comparison. Now we are going to spend the next year or 18 months or so looking at this larger data set that has already been collected in order to shrink our error bars and make an even more precise measurement. So that'll happen over the course of the next year or so. In the meantime, we're still collecting even more data to get to our ultimate goal of reducing the uncertainty on this measurement by a factor of 4.
Let's take a step back and look big picture here, right? Enrico Fermi, after whom Fermilab is named, I mean, he is often known as the father of the atomic age, the father of the atomic bomb. What are there real world, you know, consequences? I know we might be getting into a little bit of speculative territory here, but years from now, when we look back at this, what might we see, what might we think is different about our experience of the world or our understanding of the universe based on the work that you and your collaborators are doing now?
Yeah, thanks. This is one of the most interesting questions to ponder because at some level, we are doing the work to improve our fundamental knowledge of the universe so that people in the future can use that more refined knowledge to engineer new things and go new places, right? So today, it's difficult to look ahead and say, this is the exact application that's going to come out of this measurement. But if we take a step back and look to our past, right, and think about, when electricity was first discovered, it certainly did not dawn on those individuals that 100, 150 years later, everybody would be walking around with a computer in their pocket that could instantly connect them to people all the way on the other side of the world, right? So I think that the technological advances that we have come from our deep and broad understanding, and efforts like the muon G-2 experiment are really getting at understanding those building blocks so that we really have this in place and are able to move forward with a better, more precise understanding of the universe.
So Benjamin Franklin with the kite and the key, and we'll wait and see what the new smartphone that comes from this possibly down the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a good place on which to end our conversation. I want to thank Fermilab physicist Brendan Kieburg for helping us wrap our minds around the latest findings of the muon G-2 experiment at Fermilab. Brendan, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.